Welcome to Radio Physics, a collaboration with the Aspen Center for Physics, KDNK Community Radio in Carbondale, and advanced physics students from Roaring Fork Valley High Schools. The students spend a week working at the center during the summer and get to talk one-on-one to some of the distinguished physicists who are here. I'm Patty Fox, and I'm hosting today's program, which was recorded during the teen summer program at the Aspen Center for Physics. With me today are Roger Ramos from Basalt High School, Sophia Nelson from Glenwood Springs High School, and Sharmila Day, who is the daughter of two physicists who are working here this week. Also with us is physicist Pratik Agrawal, who is a postdoc at Harvard. That means he's finished his doctorate and is working on research. And he is the organizer of a workshop called The Many Faces of Naturalness. We'll begin with Roger.
We could start from the beginning. So let's just say at my age, where were you? What were your interests and sort of what led you into this physics career?
So I grew up in India, and so around your age, I was doing my high school in India. And the way it works in India is that you take these competitive exams to get into colleges, and you don't actually apply or send out applications. You just take these exams, and based on the grades on your exams, you get to go to a certain college. And also, you don't get to choose your field completely arbitrarily based on your rank on this sort of national exam. There's a list, and the first person gets to choose whatever they want to do, the second person gets to choose whatever they want to do, and so on. While I was preparing for these exams, the exams are based on physics, chemistry, math. So I was interested in math and physics more already, and I knew sort of I wanted to do something with physics and math. So when I passed that exam, I chose physics as my major just because I enjoyed physics in high school so much. But that was also a sort of a chance thing where if my rank did not allow me to choose physics, I would not be able to choose physics. I would have to take whatever was available. I think this early interest just arose from preparing for these exams and studying physics for these exams.
Hi, I'm Sophia. So did you always wanted to be a physician, or what was your job?
Physicist.
Do that all the time. Or did you change your careers just based on the classes that were provided to you?
Well, so there was not very many options to change once you've picked up stream after this entrance exam. So I knew I wanted to do physics, and I was pretty much locked down into it, but I was enjoying it, so that worked out well. After graduating from undergrad, I did work in the industry, in the data analytics industry for a year. That was the most stark contrast between physics and the outside world, where the problems I was solving were actually interesting. They were interesting mathematical problems, but they were applied to sort of data for healthcare or something like that. And I really felt like the things that I were doing were not the things that interest me in the deep at a deep level. And so I applied for grad school after working 1 year in the industry. So that was where I made an explicit choice to stay in physics rather than continue in the industry.
And are you studying dark matter for your doctorate degree?
Yes, I did specialize in dark matter for my PhD, but we're broadly interested in all aspects of physics at high energy.
So the kind of physics that you were doing in high school, is that very similar to what the kind of physics that you do now?
The rules change. The actual calculations and the sophistication of math that you need to do change. But there is some sort of texture or flavor of physics that persists, I think. And the same thing that interests me in high school about some clarity of thought of physics or thinking clearly and trying to figure out an elegant solution to whatever simple problems I was doing back then still persists. That if you're simple, if you're elegant, if you're clear, you're rewarded in physics. So in that sense, I would say yes, that there is some flavor. But of course, the kinds of problems you deal with are quite different.
What advice would you give to students who are interested in physics or science in high school?
to be on top of your material in high school itself is a good start. When I was your age, at Wikipedia or the internet or all these resources or the Khan lectures weren't really online. So there's a ton of resources out there on websites and on YouTube, and which you can actually go and look at. And most of them do a really good job of explaining deep concepts of cutting edge research into simple high school level math and physics.
So now to the nitty gritty, dark matter. What work have you done on it, and what research have you gotten from it? And if you could introduce it to us, because, you know, simplify it.
So maybe a good introductory point is going back to the discovery of Neptune. So back when we didn't actually know Neptune was a planet, we had discovered all the inner planets up to Neptune. So we had discovered Saturn and Uranus. And people looked at Uranus, and they found that the orbit of Uranus wasn't really lining up with what Newton would have predicted. So there was something fishy going on. And then a couple of people said, well, actually, if there's a planet beyond Uranus, that would explain everything. So if there's more stuff out there in our solar system, that would explain why Uranus's orbit is slightly away from what you expect from Newtonian gravity and things like that. And indeed, they could even predict where to find it. And I think they got lucky a little bit but in their calculations, but they did find it there, and it was a huge discovery. It was... And so just using gravity, you can figure out where stuff is in our solar system. And then just expand it to our galaxy, for example. As stars are rotating around the galaxy itself, different solar systems are rotating around the galaxy itself. By looking at the rotation of those stars, you can figure out how much stuff there should be, just again using Newtonian gravity. And so we again look at those stars rotating, and we find that it doesn't line up with all the matter we've observed. So there's some missing mass that you need to account for the rotations of these stars and gas in our galaxies. And so that was what was called dark matter by Zwicky. And so that's the basic concept, that there is some additional matter that we've seen through its gravitational effects, which we haven't seen anywhere else, but we know of its existence. And so there are different hypotheses of what this can be. This can't fit in our picture of particles that we have so far. So this has to be a new particle, which would mean that we have to revise our picture of how the fundamental physics universe works. And so my research and a lot of other people's research is to try and hypothesize what this particle could be. And since we've measured so many different things and we have so many different experiments running, that's not an easy thing to do. You hypothesize something, you find that, oh, this would have led to deviations in this experiment, it would have led to deviations. So there's a sort of tight game that you have to play, that you can reduce something but not actually be excluded by this vast majority of things that we've already seen. So that's part of my research, to make models of dark matter which can explain observations, which can maybe be what is going on in dark matter physics.
Based off your research, what's your latest theory of what dark matter is and what it can do for the universe?
So most of us who work on these theories actually don't believe in our theories, because we're sort of painfully aware that anything we're doing is probably a tiny slice of the truth. Even if we get sort of the right answer, we are very happy with ourselves. We're basically blind people in a dark room looking for a black cat kind of thing. So yeah. Even if we get close, we're happy. So I wouldn't actually say that there's a favorite model that I have, but as a community, what we're thinking is that one of the leading candidates for dark matter is what is called a WIMP, which is an acronym for a weakly interacting massive particle. And all that means is that we think that its properties must be roughly that its mass should be around the weak scale, which is 100 times the mass of the proton. And its interaction strength should also be dictated by that energy scale, basically. And so that broad class of models has some nice properties, one of which is that if you just trace the evolution of our universe and you just put a particle like this in, you automatically find that you explain how much dark matter there is today, which we have seen through observations. So people work a lot on these kinds of models. There's actually experiments designed to go after these kinds of dark matter models. There's people who look for to produce them in colliders, in these high-energy colliders like the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva. It goes up to 1,000 times the mass of the proton energy scale. Since you go up to these high-energy scales, you can produce these heavy particles in collisions of these two protons coming at each other at very high energies. So we might be able to produce them in our lab. Well, it's a 27-kilometer long lab, but yes, in these experiments, we might be able to produce them and study them. Or we might look for just their, instead of just gravitational properties, we might look for some other interactions when we look in our telescopes and look at our galaxies. Or people have built these giant chambers of, say, xenon, deep underground, where you say that dark matter particles are all around us, they're passing through the Earth, and maybe once they pass, as they're passing through the xenon chamber, they interact with the liquid a little bit and give you a tiny signal, very rarely, once a year or something, in these giant ton-size xenon liquid chambers. So you have to look for these very feeble interactions of dark matter with us. So people are pushing on all these different frontiers to try and find this class of models where you assume dark matter is around 100 times the mass of proton. So that I would say is probably the leading candidate, but there's other very, very well-motivated candidates that people work on, and there's a whole slew of experiments that people are trying. And hopefully there's something we haven't thought of yet, and there'll be new directions to look for.
Why is it important to know about dark matter and its properties, and how does it really affect the average person?
The honest answer is I don't know, but I can see many different possibilities where understanding how dark matter works could just help us understand, maybe in 500 years we can extract energy from dark matter and we can just use it as a perennial energy source. Is it possible? It's possible. Is it likely? I don't know. I don't know what it's made of. So I think the principle we work on as fundamental physicists is just curiosity and to find out things we haven't found before. And in the past, it's always led to discoveries which actually do help us in society. And there's spin-offs as you work on hard problems. There are spin-offs which are not directly related to the breakthrough you made, but they're still very important. And the example that everybody gives is the World Wide Web, which came out of exchanging data at the site of the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Geneva. So the experimentalists had to transfer large amounts of data, so they came up with this protocol, a World Wide Web, which was the spin-off. So the whole WWW protocol is a spin-off of just particle physicists doing their experiments.
So off of that point, even though there's a lot of things we don't know, there are things we do know. And one of those is the calculation of how much it takes up of the universe. And from what I've read, it's around 27, 28, 26%. So how did we get to that point of how much we know there actually is?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So there's this thing called the energy budget of the universe, which you are referring to. And about 70% of it is made out of this thing called dark energy, which is different from dark matter. 25% or so is made up of dark matter, and the rest of the 5% is made up of the ordinary matter that we're made of, for example. And the way we usually pin down these numbers is through a slew of observations of cosmology of the universe. One of the most significant observations is that of the cosmic microwave background. So I have to tell you a little bit of the background of what that is, but it's a very cool observation. So in the early universe, things were much hotter and much denser. So everything was basically a soup of hot plasma. All the charges were free. They weren't clumps of matter. There was just imagine a hot soup of plasma, of photons and all the fundamental particles. And since there were so many charged particles around, it turns out that this plasma was opaque, because as you emit a photon, it doesn't travel very much. Some other charged particle absorbs it. So this was just an opaque, hot plasma. And as this plasma started cooling, at some point it became neutral. So protons found electrons. I'm giving you a very simplified picture. So protons found electrons, and then they formed hydrogen atom, which is neutral, instead of free protons and electrons. So suddenly, at some point in our history, the universe became transparent. And at this point, all the photons that were emitted could just travel long distances. And so when we look back, when we look far away in our telescopes, we're looking back in time, because photons take a long time to get to us. So we look at the sun, we're looking 8 minutes ago, what coming out of the sun. If we look at Alpha Centauri, we look at some even further time ago. And so we look at the furthest distance we can look at. So that's the earliest time we could look at. And we look at this last snapshot. As the universe became transparent, all these photons got emitted, and those photons we can see at the farthest distance we can see in our optical telescopes. So in some sense, we have this in the this thing is called the cosmic microwave background. Today it's in the microwave frequency, that's why it's called the microwave background. So we have this snapshot of the early universe. It's like a picture of the early universe as we look out in the look out to far distances in our telescopes. And what we find is basically, to a very, very large extent, the early universe was basically homogeneous. So it was I forget what the exact number is, part per thousand or even better. It was just completely homogeneous. Densities was homogeneous, temperatures were homogeneous, everything was just a homogeneous thing, completely featureless. And if that would be the case, there would be no features at all in the universe. If you look at more precisely, there is actually fluctuations in this uniform density and temperature universe, and these fluctuations form the seed of what later became galaxies and stars and the whole massive structure of universe that we see. But also in the CMB, we already have information about what the composition of this featureless plasma was. And so looking at the observations of the CMB, we can figure out how much of it was dark matter, how much of it was matter that actually talked to photons. And so that's one way we figure out how much dark matter relative to baryons there is. We also have observations of the expansion history of the world, which depends on this energy budget of 70% dark energy, 25% dark matter. And there's yet another set of cosmological observations which tell us how much helium was formed, how much lithium was formed in the early universe, which we can measure. That also tells us how much ordinary matter there was, how much dark matter there was. So there's a set of different orthogonal independent observations that all point to this picture where there's 70% dark energy, 25% dark matter, and 5% ordinary matter, roughly speaking.
So, like, one interesting thing that I picked up was that the universe is, like, accelerating, it's expanding. But how do we know that dark matter and dark energy is what's accelerating it?
So the effect of dark matter and dark energy on the universe's evolution, this expansion, is quite different. That's one of the things that differentiates them. So what dark matter does is it behaves exactly like ordinary matter as far as the expansion of the universe is concerned. Which is to say that if I take a box of matter and I expand it, the density has now become diluted. If you just imagine a gas and then I just increase the volume of the container, I've diluted the density. So this is how ordinary matter or dark matter would behave. That as the universe expands, it dilutes away. So if we wait another 10 billion years, it would be the case that dark matter and ordinary matter would be completely negligible fractions of the energy budget of the universe, because they're getting diluted away as the universe is becoming bigger. Dark energy, on the other hand, is very weird. It doesn't dilute as you expand, as the universe expands. So the energy density stays the same. You add more space, it adds more energy. So it's never going to dilute away. So 10 billion years from now, dark energy would rule. Even though it's 70%, now it would be just almost 100%. So the thing that causes the acceleration of the universe, things can cause expansion, but the accelerated expansion of the universe is dark energy. And the observation of the accelerated expansion of the universe comes from dark energy, not dark matter.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on here at the Aspen Center for Physics?
I'm working on a number of things here. We're working on some aspects of dark matter physics that I worked on as a graduate student, and which is to do with how the dark matter in the early universe came to be, how it was produced, and how can we tie it with observations. There's also something related to naturalness, which we haven't hit upon yet, that I'm working on. So maybe this would be a good point to start introducing naturalness as a concept. So like I said, that we are basically blind people in a dark room looking for a black cat. So we look for hints for anything that can point us in the right direction for where physics could come from. One of it is just observations where things don't line up. So that's obviously a place to look for. So dark matter is one thing where things don't line up. So we think there's new physics to explore there. The other hint that we get is this notion of naturalness, where we look at our theories and we sort of guess based on what we know, how theories work and what are the principles that govern how we make theories. We guess what new physics should, where new physics should be. And naturalness is one such thing where we say that if you look at the standard model, which is the theory of particle physics that explains all the particle physics observations so far, it's a really beautiful theory, and it has this one interesting particle called the Higgs boson, which was found a few years ago at CERN in Geneva. And so the Higgs boson mass is around this 100 GeV scale, which is 100 times the mass of the proton. In every theory that we can think about, if there's new physics at much higher energy scales, which we believe there to be, so let's say there's new physics scales at 1,000 times that mass of the Higgs boson, or 100 billion, a million times the mass of the Higgs boson, all of these things, all of those physics would contribute, and unless there's very, very fine cancellations between unrelated physical phenomena, you would expect the Higgs mass not to be 100 times the mass of the proton, but some very large number. So the puzzle in some crude sense is, why is actually the Higgs mass only 100 times the mass of the proton and not some gigantic number which is some new physics scale, which is, let's say, Planck scale, for example. And there's different solutions proposed to why the Higgs mass is not very large. And all of those proposals actually say there should be a whole new sector of physics just right around the corner from the mass of the Higgs, which is around 100 GeV. So to just rephrase it, we say that without any new physics, the 100 GeV mass of the Higgs is unnatural. It requires some fine cancellations between parameters in physics, which nobody, it seems like, why would nature choose to cancel unrelated parameters in this fine way? Maybe there's a symmetry there. And that symmetry predicts new particles at around the Higgs mass. So one of the big programs at the Large Hadron Collider is to search for this new physics right around the corner. But unfortunately, so far, we haven't found anything. So then that makes us think, well, maybe there's something wrong with this argument that if I say I believe in naturalness, then I should expect new physics right around the corner. But I'm not seeing anything. So maybe this principle doesn't work exactly. Maybe there's some cancellation going on just randomly. It's just a coincidence, and I have to live with that. Maybe I'm not thinking about the problem in the right way. Maybe there are other theories which don't predict particles just around the corner, but still make the Higgs mass somehow natural. So these are the sort of issues that we're wrestling with as data from the LHC is coming in, and we don't have a definitive signal for any of these natural theories that we were expecting. And we're wrestling with these issues of whether we're understanding the problem, what's wrong with this argument that we were making for decades, that we should expect new physics at around 100 GeV scale. And we build these colliders partly because we were expecting this new physics to be discovered. So that's sort of the state our field is in, and so that's why we're hosting a workshop here at ACP on this topic. What I'm working on is one of these new solutions of naturalness, which do not predict new particles around the weak scale. So, which is an interesting new development, which we're trying to see if it makes sense or not.
Thank you so much, all of you, Roger and Sophia and Sharmila, and especially thank you, Pratik, for your very interesting questions and answers. And we will look forward to the next Radio Physics 4:30 on the last Tuesday of the month.